it's sometimes important to make a statement and to realize that music shouldn't always necessarily make us feel warm and fuzzy. Sometimes there's room for taking the risk and making people really sit back and think and question things and feel a little bit uncomfortable. I think that there's beauty in that.
That's clarinetist Mark Dover of Imani Winds. He and bassoonist Monica Ellis recently talked with me about their newest recording, which will make you think. It's called Brutes. That's what we're hearing about this week on New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Almacher. I'm talking with Monica Ellis, the bassoonist of Imani Winds, and clarinetist Mark Dover, who's also in the quintet. Thank you so much for joining me. Monica, you were a band kid growing up in Pittsburgh. I'm curious how the bassoon became your primary instrument.
Well, you're right. I was a band kid, self-proclaimed band kid in my beloved city of Pittsburgh. And I I was influenced by my teachers that really, really helped me to see what my potential was. And in middle school, I had a great band teacher, and shout out to Arthur Powell, Pittsburgh Public Schools, Margaret Lyons, my middle school band director there. And I was playing clarinet and saxophone and actually quite a bit of piano too, outside of school, taking private lessons. And that was the point where he said, why don't you try another instrument, and maybe there could be some other opportunities for you. And I think that we actually received the instrument for our school at that time. And I kind of tried it and thought, okay, I have no idea what this is. I remember bringing the box home too, like lugging this big, big old case that my parents were like, sure, whatever. You know, that type of acceptance was really encouraging as well. But my clarinet teacher at the time also played bassoon. And for a while I studied with him, which I think really started me to have good habits. And he, though, had the foresight to introduce me to one of the players in the Pittsburgh Symphony, Mark Pantsarev, who I actually ended up studying with all through high school. And he prepared me for auditions and everything. And so that kind of direction, even then, I think is really amazing that teacher thought, OK, she should have someone else that can kind of take me further. So I'm always appreciative for him and for that reason.
Having such great teachers. Your first teacher was your father, the late jazz saxophonist Clarence Oden. What was it like to study with him?
Well, I mean, you know, study with him was like us watching The Cosby Show growing up and Cheers every night. And so it wasn't really a study per se. It was more about just the exposure to him playing and seeing it. I mean, in all honesty, you know, he had his proverbial day job working at Blue Cross Blue Shield, taking care of his family, and he would play on the weekends and at evenings. And so we would see him perform, not a lot, to tell you the truth, but it was always there. It was always just kind of in our environment, in the ethos. And, you know, his records were there. And so it was more like just the support that every kid should have. I would hope that every kid would have the support that my parents gave me and my sister to just live your dreams and do your best and be there at every concert, every performance, everything. So it was less about the study of it and more about just encouragement. And him passing away when I was 15, you know, of course, is so much missed opportunities that were to come. He never really saw me play the bassoon much. And so that's always a bittersweet thing. But the setup was there. And so for that, I'm eternally grateful.
And you have a young son. Is he named? Is your dad his namesake?
He sure is. Yes, yes. You know all about me. Yes, Odin, my 7-year-old boy, is named after my father. Yes. The Clarence part, we talked about it. We thought about it. And I said, I think the Odin is a good first name versus the straight up exact same name. Let's kind of switch it up and put the last name as the first name. So he's a kid that has a whole bunch of last names. He has my dad's last name, and then his last name is mine and his dad's hyphenated. So Odin Ellis Harris, there's a whole lot of names, a whole lot of last names as your names.
Monica, what does it mean to you to be one of the founding members of Imani Winds?
it really means everything. I mean, it has turned into my life's work for the last 24 years. It means a legacy. It means, frankly, Black excellence. It means the ability to share our joys and what we think is important in the world of classical music. It means inspiration to, we hope, a whole nother generation that has emerged since we've been doing this for so long. It also means it's pride too. It's but not in a boastful way. And I hope it's not, but always try to stay grounded and stay gracious and grateful. But to see that after, you know, over two decades of this work, it does make me very proud that what we've done and what we've been able to continue to do is just, you know, really, really special. So yeah. And by the way, it's fun and funny. It's actually hilarious. We have a ball, even in this pandemic and the quarantine times, we've been able to maintain a connection with one another. And that foundation that we established on the road and on the stage was and continues to be able to kind of translate into these times when we're not able to be together. So yet again, very, very grateful for, you know, my family, like that Mark Dover sitting right there and all the other guys in the band that we really, really have, you know, a true love for each other and a love for the music that we want to bring. And it means everything.
Mark, you joined Imani Winds in 2016. Why did you want to be part of this group?
Well, you know, I actually kind of came up as a young student of the music and was a big fan of the quintet for years. So they came to Interlaken when I was a student there in the summer. And so I saw them when I was like 15 years old. And then later on, when I was an undergraduate at University of Michigan, is when I really kind of, I saw them with Wayne Shorter at Hill Auditorium. And that was just like an unbelievable concert. And so I'd always just been a fan. I'd listened to their records. And as a wind player, you know, Imani Winds is like, you know, they were kind of it. There's other wind quintets, but they were the ones that were like truly making the biggest impact on the genre. So I just really was a huge fan. And so when I was, you know, flash forward to 2015, I got an email from them inviting me to audition. And I had been in New York freelancing for a few years, kind of struggling a bit. And so, I mean, it was a no-brainer. It was an absolute no-brainer to put my name in the hat for that.
Mark, what did it feel like when you got that email inviting you to audition for Imani Winds?
Well, it's funny. I always tell people at first, it didn't even seem like an invite at first. It was like the subject said a message from Imani Winds. And so I thought it was like an e-blast thing. And then I was like, well, you know, read it. And I scrolled down and I realized it was an invite to audition. So I was super, I mean, I couldn't believe it, but you know, then there was a long road ahead because there was like multiple rounds of submitting recordings and stuff. And then a live round and then, you know, quite a bit of time when they were figuring it all out. So it was definitely a lot of work, but actually most of the work came when I got the gig because I had never played in a wind quintet before. So there was a whole ton of, you know, a pile of music that I had to dive into. It really does kind of seem like it has not been 5 years, but it has been 5 years. It's been a whirlwind. Definitely the highlight of my career so far was when I got that gig.
And you've had a lot of highlights. I mean, you're part of the Manhattan Chamber Players. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
And you have an extensive background in jazz and improvised music. How do all these worlds intersect or complement the work you do with Imani Winds?
You know, I think one of the things that I bring to the group is that I do kind of have my foot in different genres and in different musical territories, if you will. And Imani has always been such an amazing environment in terms of fostering those different things and letting me still have the freedom to pursue different avenues. And since, you know, we are a full-time chamber ensemble, but we do have more of a flexibility than you might have like in an orchestra job in terms of that we have down periods and we have parts of the season where we're a little bit less busy. So I am able to kind of navigate the other things in my life as we all are in the group. We teach at different schools and do different musical things. And then within the group itself, there's just such a vast array of different musical styles that we perform in. As if you listen to this upcoming album, you'll hear that there's some improvisatory things, and you know, we've worked a lot with jazz composers and musicians in world music, and you know, klezmer music, and just music from so many different kind of traditions and cultures. So it's definitely like a melting pot of a gig for me, which is an amazing thing to be able to have that kind of just freedom artistically.
Let's talk about this new recording. The new recording is titled Bruits. It's spelled B-R-U-I-T-S. And this may be an unfamiliar term for many. Who would like to describe and explain the title of this new recording?
Yeah, I'll dive into that. It's a medical term in many regards, and it is the sound that blood makes as it's flowing through the body if something's wrong. So it's some sort of a blockage type of sound. And so when doctors hear that, then the blood is not flowing properly. And so it's obviously a metaphor in the sense of, you know, why would you name a piece of music like that? But what Vijay was really trying to achieve, I think, was to represent the blockage of life in many ways that so many Black and Brown people are experiencing in this country, and the piece does represent that. And so it is kind of a heady word. And so the cover of the album has the word, the phonetic spelling, and the definition. And we recognize that it would be something that people would not really know about. It also has a French pronunciation, bruit, which basically means the same thing. We worked really hard too. We researched really hard to try to see the different pronunciations and see which one would be correct. And we came up like right down the middle. Even Steven, some people say bruit, some say brutes, some say brute. So we thought that it would also be an interesting way if we used the quote American way to say it, because you know it means forceful as well. You know, just the double meaning of it. So it's a provocative word, and it's a provocative piece, and it really does have a lot of, you know, really intense moments to it and intense meanings behind it. So we just love the piece and think that it has so much to say, and we're really excited about recording it and making it the feature of this record.
It has a lot to say, and there is spoken word within it as well. Can you tell me a little bit about the composer, Vijay Iyer, and why he wrote this work for you? And then walk us through the movements, please.
So, you know, the inspiration for the piece was surrounding the murder of Trayvon Martin. And, you know, that is obviously something that we don't take lightly. The first movement opens with this kind of ethereal music that's all completely instrumental between the wind quintet, which, to let you know, is flute, oboe, clarinet, French horn, and bassoon, and the piano. So it's very textural, very ethereal. And then all of a sudden, the second movement, you hear the instruments playing sounds. Not notes, but making noises on our instruments. In this percussive hocketing type way.
Chapter 776, Justifiable Use of Force.
And over that sound, you hear us speaking this case law of the Stand Your Ground law from Florida, but it's slightly phased.
And to the extent that the person reasonably believes that such conduct is necessary to defend himself or herself or another against the other's imminent use of unlawful force.
So it's two people speaking in unison, this very kind of declamatory case law, but the voices kind of come in and out of each other. And then that leads into this kind of piano improvisation at the end of the movement. And so when a listener hears it, they're going to be a bit confused and a bit shocked, maybe. but I think it's very effective and powerful.
A person does not have a duty to retreat if the person is in a place where he or she has a right to be.
The rest of the movements are all written out. They're all, you know, for the most part, instrumental. One of the movements is all just the instruments playing one note and we flock to each other. Like one person plays a note and then the next person tries to match that note. And then the next person plays another note and we all try to like come in and out, kind of like a flock of birds following each other. It's a really powerful piece, and you know, I don't want to give away too much, but you know, Vijay as a composer, you really hear his influence as an improviser, because I think there is a very improvisatory kind of feeling to the music. In the fifth and final movement, you'll hear our flutist Brandon play this beautiful kind of improvised solo. That leads to the epic finale of the piece. So you kind of hear this dichotomy between Vijay Iyer, the incredible improviser, and Vijay Iyer, the classical new music composer.
Tell me how audiences have been responding to this piece when you play it live for them.
The audience response is they are affected by it. I think people hear it and know that they've heard something, that they've just heard something that they have not heard before, that is a kind of a courageous thing to hear, particularly from a so-called classical ensemble. You know, we don't have a platform per se of, and I say that per se, like in big, big letters, of you know, radical type of music. We may play this piece alongside other pieces that may not have as big of a social impact. So there's an unexpected quality to it, but at the same time, I think people recognize the artistry behind it, not only in the composition, but the playing as well. And so that takes hold of people and allows for it to come through. A funny story is that when we premiered the piece, which was in 2014 down in Florida, and as Mark explained, you know, Vijay was so affected by the murder of Trayvon Martin being in Florida, and also the murder of Jordan Davis, who was the young Black man who, you know, just barely out of his teens, who was killed for playing his music too loud at the gas station. That story also in Florida. And so we played it in Sarasota and we premiered it on, it was a festival and it wasn't just us. And everything else on it was really, really classical, like not even, you know, somewhat new music-y. Like we're talking like Mozart, Vivaldi, the super classics. And so we were sort of sandwiched in between these ultra classical pieces on the concert, and everybody was really taken back. But again, the response was really, really powerful. I mean, in the moment, as well as after the concert, people were affected by it. They realized that they're listening to something important. And this is not like, oh, me being boastful, it's important. It's just the message is important. You know, they realized like, okay, this is something that we need to take note of and really take in. It does have a really, really powerful impact.
How do each of you feel when you play this piece?
I would say, on a musical level, you know, I feel inspired and impassioned because I love Vijay's music and I always have. And so I think just talking about that, I think it's very pleasing and gratifying to play his music. And then on top of that, I think the message behind the music is so important. And I think the way I feel when I play a piece changes depending on where I'm playing it in a big way. So sometimes, you know, we play a piece at a venue, you know, where you can kind of sense that maybe it's a little uncomfortable for people to hear. And actually, I think that that's important. And I think that's one of the reasons why we chose to release this album and to perform this music live, because I think that with everything that's happening today, and just in general, it's sometimes important to make a statement and to realize that music shouldn't always necessarily make us feel warm and fuzzy. Sometimes there's room for taking the risk and making people really sit back and think and question things and feel a little bit uncomfortable. I think that there's beauty in that. So I've definitely felt that somewhat performing this piece. But then the thing is that you might feel that when you're performing, and then you step into the lobby after the concert and everyone was like, that was so incredible. Like, you know, we're behind you, you know? So it's that's one of the beauties of live performance, is you never really know what the impact that you're setting out to give people is going to land in the way that you want it to. So that kind of uncertainty to me gives me, it kind of galvanizes me and I find it really rewarding.
And I'll say, to be very practical at first, I get kind of nervous because it's hard. The piece is not easy. Just from a very technical point of view, there's loads of notes. There's an endurance aspect to it. You know, you kind of have to pace yourself. Just the listening that's involved. And by the way, we should also say it involves piano. The incredible Corey Smythe, who is on the record and who's actually the only one that's ever played it with us. Just an awesome piano player and person as well, and collaborator. And so because we have him, there's yet another energy on the stage. You know, there's another person just offering their input musically. And so that, from a musician's point of view, is really exciting and something that we don't often get the chance to do, because 90% of the time we are just the quintet, which is more than enough, let me tell you. No. But so that's really fun and exciting. So yeah, and you know, just honored. I'm always honored that people want to hear what Imani Wins is doing. I don't take it for granted whatsoever that for the last, you know, 1 year and 24 years that people are still interested in what we offer. And so I'm humbled by that and consider it a responsibility to continue to bring music that is going to make people think, whether that's in a somewhat lighthearted way or in a much more serious way, like this piece and this record is doing. Either way, I'm always, you know, I'm ready for it.
All three pieces on this recording are world premieres. Rena Esmail wrote a piece called The Light is the Same. It was commissioned in 2016, and it features two contrasting ideas.
The two ideas that you're referring to, the piece is actually based on these two rags, which are kind of like a scale or mode. And so one of them is this dark, brooding, complex rag, and the other one is a more light and innocent rag. But there's really only one note that is different between them. And so her idea behind the piece is based on these words that she came across from the Sufi mystic poet Rumi. Religions are many, but God is one. The lamps may be different, but the light is the same. And so he's stating, you know, that even if our methods for searching for meaning may look very different, the things that we seek are so similar. And so those two rags that she's using are kind of, you know, a metaphor to that concept. And so it's a very beautiful piece. And I kind of, we think of the piece somewhat in, well, two, maybe three different sections, but the opening of the piece, you hear these rags kind of emerge between the instruments and kind of dovetail between the different voices. it sounds very, you know, like VJ's piece in a way, very improvisatory at times. It's supposed to have the feeling of just kind of these lines emerging from out of nowhere. It is just so beautiful and lush, and the harmonies and textures are incredible. And then later in the piece, it jumps into this very dance-like section where the meter, the rhythmic meter, is changing drastically all the time. So instead of hearing something like 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, we're hearing 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, and it's just like kind of a party up to the end of the piece. So it definitely, the piece just kind of drops like from like a hat from that beautiful opening into this dance-like section. It's a piece that we've played now for a few years, and we love Rena's music so much, and I think the piece is just a joy to play and to listen to.
It also has a connection to The Planets by Gustav Holst. Who would like to talk about that connection?
Yeah, I have to give credit to our oboist, Toyin Spellman-Diaz, who really had this original concept. And it was her idea to look at Holst's Planets, which was 100 when we commissioned Rena, and to use that piece. We happen to have an arrangement, believe it or not, of some of the movements of that piece. And that's like a whole other story in and of itself, that we've done commissioned a man named Jonathan Russell to do some arrangements of large, humongous orchestral works, one of which was The Rite of Spring and then Scheherazade. And so like these huge mega works kind of pared down, taken to their smallest common denominators, 4 or 5 people. So we asked him to also do The Planets. And so within that commission and that idea, we thought, well, what if we had a companion piece of sorts that would just allow to us to have this program concept of looking at the universe, of looking at the stars and literally the planets in the sky and kind of this mystic idea. And so Rena's music, which we had been exploring and checking out, seemed to be an interesting fit to bring those two pieces together. At the end of the day, we do have that origin story as far as how the two pieces came together, but we recognize, and this only happens after you're in it and after you perform it and you know, see how a piece fits in other programs, we recognize that they don't really have to be paired at all. You know, they have both of them can exist apart from each other, and clearly Rena's piece we thought would be a good fit for this album project. But yes, in its original concept, it was kind of matching to have this element of the cosmos and what are we really looking at and what is our purpose and what is our feelings about, you know, how we can kind of come together and not look at the differences that we have, but our similarities.
We need a new American Revolution.
Tell me about Dr. John Hope Franklin, who is the subject of Frederick Jeffsky's piece called Sometimes.
John Hope Franklin was an African-American historian and scholar. And upon the celebration of his centennial, Duke University commissioned Fred Jeffsky to write a piece for us because Franklin was a professor at Duke, among many other places. But that was one of the final places where he was a professor. And he had particular scholarly knowledge of the Reconstruction period, which is that period after the Civil War, where there actually was quite a bit of African-American establishment and the ability to create neighborhoods and families and political power. Of course, it was very short-lived until the 1900s when, you know, the reign of Jim Crow and terror occurred. And so he reflects upon that, John Hope Franklin, in many of his writings upon that period, but also throughout the rest of the 1900s. So he's a very important scholar in the history of Black people in this country. And Duke University wanted to celebrate him when his centennial came upon us. And so that is how the piece came about because they commissioned Fred Jeffsky on our behalf to write for us. And Fred really wanted to incorporate his actual words in the piece and not just, you know, sort of an idea of him, but use his words, use actual writings. And so we were really fortunate that I ended up getting quite close with his son, John Whittington Franklin, who has extended his legacy and really works on his behalf to make sure that, you know, his legacy is very much intact. And so he speaks the words of his father in that first movement of the piece, which I thought was, you know, particularly poignant.
This is what the first American Revolution did not have. This is what the new American Revolution must have.
There's another featured performer on that piece as well, and she happens to be an opera singer.
Janai Brugger is an amazing soprano who actually I went to undergrad with at Michigan. So we're old friends and, you know, friends with her husband, who's an amazing violinist. So when we were thinking of who to reach out to sing this part, when we do it in concert, actually, we have Toyin sing it. And Toyin is an amazing singer in her own right. But we thought we would feature a singer outside of the group for this. And we reached out to Janai, who sings regularly at the Met and, you know, won the Operalia World Competition. She's just a very established singer. She was so gracious and immediately said yes. So we brought her into the studio to record, and she knocked it out of the park. Monica was in the studio that day, and remember her texting me, she's got it.
It was beautiful. It was just beautiful. And the words are of a Langston Hughes poem that Jeffsky decided to put to music. The poem is God to Hungry Child, and which also has, you know, very poignant words about what we have not done for our society. The rich get richer, the businesses just continue to make, but what about the rest of us? What about the hungry children and you know, all of those that are left behind, so to speak? I think one of the cool things about the piece is that it does, again, have this arc of spoken word at the bookends of it. We have John Hope Franklin spoken by his son, and then we have the words of Langston Hughes sung by Janai Brugger, this incredible, beautiful singer. And, you know, it does sort of have this arc to it. And then all juxtaposed with a Negro spiritual, Sometimes I Feel Like a Motherless Child, which we hear in its original unadulterated form with the bassoon solo, which I was, you know, really grateful to be able to play. But then he just completely breaks it apart, deconstructs it, kind of turns it on its head. Just for it to not really come back together. Which is interesting too. It's not like, oh, let's make this package nice and neat back together again. And here you'll hear the spiritual again. You don't hear it, you know, which is certainly synonymous to the plight that we're dealing with right now. You know, it's going to take a really long time for us to sort of come out of the muck and that we're in. It just goes to show that everything is not a perfect little package for you.
You're really trying to move social issues forward, diversity in classical music forward. I do wonder, though, what does diversity in classical music look like, and how can we move it even further down the road? in a positive direction. It's something I know that we're all really working toward and trying to figure out what we can do to make it happen.
Well, it's such a multifaceted answer, and it's something that's not easy for me to speak about with any level of, you know, I don't know what things are going to be like in 10 years. But what I will say is that when you ask the question, what should diversity in classical music look like, I would immediately say the representation should be a reflection of what our society looks like, right? So when you look at the demographics of New York City, for instance, what should an audience at Geffen Hall or Alice Tully Hall look like? Well, in a perfect world, I think it should be proportional to the per capita demographics of the society that we're in. Now, how do we get there is a whole different question, because I think that there's no easy answer. I will say that, like most things, I think it needs to start at the root. It needs to start with our youngest generation. It needs to start with access to the arts for all, regardless of socioeconomic status, regardless of the color of your skin or anything else about you. We should have equal access to the arts. And I, you know, how do we get there? Then that's another wormhole. Funding for the arts, the National Endowment for the Arts. I mean, our budget for that is, you know, atrocious. And, you know, people who work in public radio are well aware of the red tape that comes with trying to fund arts organizations and nonprofit sector and everything. So it's a really tough question. I think maybe Monica could speak more to other things, but I do want to say that access to the arts and specifically music education, because that is something that's always one of the first things to go in our public schools. I am very fortunate to come from Ann Arbor, Michigan, where we have a great public music program, and everyone is starting at the age of 10 in fifth grade. Everyone is given free instruments if they need them. That is a rarity, increasingly rare around the country. And if we are able to inspire our youth from that age, regardless of whether or not they keep playing their instruments, they're going to have an appreciation for the arts. The return on that is very valuable.
I would add, I mean, it's incredible words from Mark. And I would say diversity also is not only what Mark was mentioning, but at every level. I mean, I think when you think about what any type of diverse circumstance is going to be, it's not solely in one area. So wind quintet playing, diversity. Okay, Imani Wins has checked off that box and now we're done. No, not even in the least bit. It should run the gamut of styles, of periods, and then of hierarchy within different organizations, where at the board level of major organizations, how diverse is that? How many voices are coming to that table that allow for there to be marginalized people's ideas, you know? And that's not to say that every Black leader represents every Black person. No, you know, it's not monolithic either, which is why you have to have several voices, has several opinions. The same idea of saying we check off the box for Wayne Quintet, which is actually kind of small, so we might check off the box for Wayne Quintet. But anyway, but is, you know, should a board of 15 people at a major arts organization have one Black person on it? And then you say, okay, we're done with diversifying the board. No, it should not, because that person can't, and should, nor should they be the spokesperson for an entire race. And so, you know, so I think it's that type of sensitivity and awareness that major organizations have to have. And then that trickle down, that the equity and the trickle down will eventually start to occur. So, you know, we do see, as Mark is saying, more diversity at the ground level with arts education. And by the way, there's some great work that's being done. You know, we've been doing lots of these kinds of conversations since last summer and even long before, frankly. You know, this work didn't just happen last summer at all. And I think we don't often recognize groups and organizations that have been putting in the work, Imani Wins notwithstanding, and that have a history and reputation for bringing diverse arts and showing diverse voices at various levels. And so, you know, that recognition is being shown, which I think is encouraging. Also, I think that it's important to recognize that classical music in and of itself is a European construct. I mean, it's not an American made thing, right, to begin with. And so that doesn't mean we just throw the baby out with the bathwater. But if you sort of take that and recognize that at its onset, then you say, well, how do we adapt it to an American experience? Then you are already kind of thinking more broadly. You know, I think we sort of try to put the square peg in the round hole too much and not look at where it came from in the first place. I had this conversation with orchestras and saying, well, why can't orchestras be more diverse? Well, orchestras are European. Like, that's just what they are. So, okay, let's recognize that, but then recognize how we can shape it to be a more American reflection. You know, there's just like baseline awareness of certain things. And then there's some real commitment that has to happen at different levels. I think it's all there, but we just got to put in the work to really see the differences.
I'm looking up the word Imani, and I'm wondering how you're defining it to represent the ensemble.
Well, so Imani is one of the seven principles of Kwanzaa, and it means faith. And so how do we define that is the ensemble? Well, I mean, we have to have faith in each other. I think actually one of the greatest tenets to chamber music is faith and believing in the energy that exists between us when we're on stage, believing in our ability to communicate with one another, trusting each other, taking risks with each other. So I think the name that our founding flutist Valerie Coleman came up with before she even formed the group, she had the name. She had a lot of faith early on. And I think, you know, Imani, well before I joined in 2016, went through years of you know, blood, sweat, and tears to get to where they are. And it took a whole lot of faith. I think I can speak for the group in that one. If there's one thing that I take from that name is that we try to apply Imani in everything that we do, not to sound, you know, too kumbaya with it. But I think that is kind of what happens.
Do you want to add anything to that, Monica?
Absolutely well said. Jeff and I have a running joke. You got to believe in something. You got to believe in something.
Clarinetist Mark Dover and bassoonist Monica Ellis talking about their latest release with Imani Winds. It's called Brutes. If you're enjoying this podcast, the best thing that you can do for the show is to tell somebody else about it and help spread the word, and take a moment to rate and review us on your podcasting app. Special thanks to producer Valerie Kaler. This is New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Amacher.